this up? I'm going to set my water on this. Thank you. Let's see if this will work. Can y'all hear me?
Yes.
Huh? No. Well, I suppose I can set it there. Y'all feel better about that? I was sensing a little bit more ease with
it.
Just trying to break the tension. At least mine anyway. Rick, that was well done, man. Appreciate it. Very well thought out. Thank you for that. Think about spiritual generation. Isaiah 60:22 says that a small one shall become, a little one shall become a little one shall become a thousand, and a small one a mighty nation. But I, the Lord, will hasten it in my time. One. God is looking for one. And he will begin to build. And so God brought one man here. And he has built this. It has nothing to do with that man. It has everything to do with God. And just taking a life that was willing to come and be a part of his work. So, thank you. My brother-in-law, who we've spent years and years, he's a hat guy. A hat hound, I would call him. But you dress well, too, man, and I really appreciate that. One of my guilty pleasures is I'm kind of a clothes and shoe hound, so that's just something I don't like to have, but you do dress well now, I do appreciate that. My oldest grandchild, Bryce, who's 16 in the high school, about 10 years ago, he and I were at the movies, and, you know, his generation, television is internet, and it's cable, and it's satellite dish, in this thing called a DVR, you know, digital recorder, and, you know, you can pause live TV. I mean, it's just, the first time I saw it, I thought, this is amazing. I'm at the movies with Bryce, he's six, watching the previews, and I said, man, I got to go to the bathroom. And saw this lady sitting next to me and said, would you mind watching my grandson? And she goes, no problem. I said, hey, Bryce, Papa's got to go to the bathroom. This nice lady's going to watch you. And he goes, okay, Papa. He said, you want to pause the previews? I said, man, that is so thoughtful of you, Bryce, but we can't pause the previews here at the movies. But thank you for thinking of it. Well, Lord, we just thank you for this time. Thank you to be here amongst your people, to be here with you. And Lord, as I was reading this morning in the 139th Psalm, you say that you know our thoughts before we think them. And you know our words before we speak them. So I just thank you for the time that you and I have spent together to come to here to this point. And you already know my thoughts and my words. So thank you. And look forward to you, what you want to say this morning. So Jesus, we just pray in your precious and holy name. Amen. Who are you, Lord, and what do you want me to do? What do you want me to give my life to? Talked a little bit like last night in my introduction in Acts 9 and Acts 26 when Paul encounters Jesus. So that'll be kind of the basis of which I'm going to be working from this week and repeating those two questions as they've kind of played themselves out in my life. I was born December 19th, 1959, Odessa, Texas, Johnny and Rhonda Cuthbert. Chip, you want to bring the slide up, please? You might wonder, why am I giving all that detail? Because normally someone might just say I was born blah, blah in this year. Well, God tells us right here why he placed us in the families that he placed us in, the time that he places us in history. From one man he made all the nations that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. And God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him though he is not far from any one of us. God, in every person's life that comes to Jesus Christ, has used that family. And I would encourage you to take some time and think about the family that you grew up in and how God used that family as a part of your journey in coming to Jesus Christ. So I mentioned last night, I grew up in a very, walking in the park on a very sunny, beautiful, cool breeze Sunday afternoon. There were no hardships. And I know many of your stories in here, you guys had hardships that you grew up with. I did not. I'm an only child in that. So I'm obviously the center of attention in my home. But I can tell you, being an only child, it's lonely. My dad didn't know how to spend time with me until I could throw or catch a ball. So probably the first 9 years of my life, my dad's not very active in my life. But that's okay, because that dad was giving me everything he could give me. Now that I understand his childhood, I can be okay with that. He did the best he could. Quiet home, very peaceful, very ordered. Mom and dad got along. They were best friends. Social drinking, but there's no alcoholism. There's no drugs. There's no verbal abuse, no physical abuse. It is just a wonderful home to grow up in. But it was a performance-based love home. So I felt like, as far as I'm performing, Mom and Dad are going to love me. It was an image-driven home, meaning we're going to look like the all-American family. It's going to look like Leave It to Beaver. And that was the culture that Dad was shaping. And so that's what I grew up in. It's about image. It's about how you look. How do you present yourself, especially when you're outside of this home? We got to present image. And so I'm growing up with, they dressed me well. Maybe that's why I enjoy clothes today. But it's all about image. Dad was, he was judgmental. He was critical. And I began to pick that up, I think, growing up, listening to my dad judge people and be critical of them. I don't know that I was so much verbally critical, but in my mind, I could be very critical in judging of people. And later in life, as I would watch my mom and dad interact with each other, my dad would speak condescendingly to my mother. And her countenance would just change, and it was like she was a child. It's like he's speaking to a child, and I felt so bad for her that my dad would speak this way, because Dad was a very prideful individual. And I addressed it with him, and I'm not sure that it went the way I thought it might go. But I asked Terry, I said, "Do you think my dad was like this when I was growing up? Because I just don't remember." And she goes, "Oh, absolutely. There's no way he just all of a sudden starts speaking condescending to your mother." So, but you get whatever your home looked like growing up, that was normal. That's what you know as normal. Even if it's wild and crazy and chaos, that's normal to you. And so I have to imagine Dad probably spoke condescendingly as well. So again, no hardships. But I had two what I would consider significant events that took place in my life in my parents' home. One, when I was the age of 5, my parents had, his parents lived in Odessa. That's where Mom and Dad grew up. They go on vacation and leave them with my dad's parents. And I'm over at some friends of theirs, and they have two little girls that are my age, and so I spend the afternoon playing, and they taking me back home, and we stop at a Whataburger to go to the bathroom. And back then, for those of you who are my age, that the bathrooms are on the outside of the stores, and they're typically in the back, okay? So you got to walk all the way to the back on the outside. And so we're walking, she takes the girls and takes them in, I go into the men's bathroom, and I notice a black truck. I don't think anything about a black truck. And so I go in, and I take them. I go to the bathroom, and I'm getting ready to leave, and a man walks in, and he locks the door. Well, in that moment, I don't think anything about it. And he tells me that he wants me to do something. And so I do what he asked me to do. and then he starts to sexually molest me. And, you know, in that moment, you know at 5 years old that this is not right, that, you know, what this man's doing to you. After a bit, fortunately, the mother knocks on the door and asks me if I'm okay. And I just said, I got to go. I pull myself together, get myself straightened up, and I go out the door. And I think I'm in shock at what has just happened. I am feeling shame. I feel guilt. I think I've done something wrong. I'm embarrassed and humiliated. I don't say anything to them because I'm overwhelmed in the moment. I get home and I tell my grandmother, she calls them, and the man goes back up there, but the guy's gone by then. So that deal's done with. And I'm sure they told my mom and dad, but I don't remember what they did about it. They didn't do counseling back then, you know, so I don't think there was any counseling that went on. So I had that. And then when I was about 9 years old, I'm walking through the house one day, and my dad says, Gary, come here. He said, hey, you're a big boy now, and we don't need to say and tell each other that we love each other anymore. And I said, okay. So I just kind of bebop and go on. I really don't think much about it. And so at the end of my talk this morning, I'm going to come back to these two incidences here. So I'm going to jump to high school. And by now, I've got a pretty good image going, pretty all-American image going. I'm a really good athlete, enjoy playing sports, played all baseball, football, and baseball through my freshman year. Played a little varsity baseball my freshman year, and then we transfer schools. And my sophomore year, I make the varsity baseball team starting as a sophomore. So this is just feeding that image just wonderfully. And then just played baseball and football through the last 3 years. My junior year, playing quarterback, I worked my way into the starting position. So all these things are just feeding this image. And my freshman year, I met my first dance, and the school I'm at is about 70% white, 30% black. Believe me, I mean nothing racial about this. It's just the mix of the population. And I'm at the dance, and I'm watching the black guys dance, and I think, oh my gosh, man, these guys can dance. They got rhythm, they got soul, and I'm thinking, I wonder if I can do this. And so I start trying some of their moves, and I think, I can do this. I got this. And so I transferred to my high school, and I know a lot of people there, so it wasn't a big transfer. Well, it's 99.9% white, you know, and there's no reason why we chose that school other than I just had a lot of friends there, and that I wanted to, if we're going to move, that's where I want to go. So we have our first dance, and I invited date, and they had a dance contest, and I won the dance contest. Because they've not seen a white boy dance like this. And so that just feeds the ego. And so then I start adding in some Jackson 5 moves. And then I start adding in the robot, you know, to it. And then all of a sudden, man, I'm teaching guys how to dance like this and how to do the robot. So it was it's just feeding the ego. I got called out a few times by a few of the girls that we hung out with because apparently I had somewhat of cocky behavior. I wasn't promoting myself verbally, but apparently the way I handled myself and the way people observed me, it was a bit cocky, which doesn't surprise me because of this image that I wanted to project. I ran with the most popular crowd, with the elite crowd. So it was just everything that fed that ego. But behind the image was fear and worry, deceit, a liar, a cheat, drinking, sex, gossip, critical, and judging. That's what lied behind all that, but I can mask all of that. In my view of eternal life, fortunately, Mom and Dad did a pretty nice job, at least up through junior high, of where I knew the gospel, meaning I knew that Jesus was the Son of God. I knew that he died on the cross for the sins of people. And I knew that he was resurrected from the dead. And I knew that he ascended into heaven. But that meant nothing to me because I wasn't a sinner. That was my view of myself. And 1 John 1:8 says that he who believes he has no sin is deceived. And that's who I was. I was deceived that I was a sinner. I mean, I thought I was pretty golden and that I was headed to heaven based on my own wonderful life that I had. My ego, my image, my pride was so beautiful that God was going to let me enter into his heaven. Go to the next slide. I don't know. Can y'all read that? I thought I made that bigger. Anyway, that's the verse I quoted last night. It says to open their eyes from darkness to light, from the power of Satan to God, so that they may receive forgiveness and eternal inheritance among those who have been sanctified, set apart by faith in me. Well, my sophomore year in college, my mom starts going back to church. And it's not a denomination I grew up in. It was a denomination she grew up in. It's a mega church. And I walk in and it's a 5,000-seat auditorium. That's pretty overwhelming in and of itself. And I'm sitting listening to teaching that I had never heard before. I thought this guy was a guy named John Bassanio. Some of you may have heard of him. You may have even heard him teach. But he was outstanding. But at the end of his talk, he said, if you would like to talk to somebody about Jesus or place your faith in Jesus, you want to come down and talk to somebody? And I thought to myself, well, why would I do that? I don't even need Jesus. So that means nothing to me. So the next several times I come back, that same thing at the end comes. And about the third time I'm sitting there, let me just back up right quick. The summer leading up to this, one of my very good friends kept saying to me over and over, he said, Gary, you need Jesus. Gary, you need Jesus. Gary, you need Jesus. I'm thinking, dude, what are you talking about? I don't need him. Just stop. Right? But that was God. That was the beginning. And over a year's time, I would come to know Jesus. But that started it. And so about the third or fourth time we're sitting in church and that invitation comes, and all of a sudden, I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, God says that all have sinned and fall short of God's glory. Now, my definition of sin are guys that are sitting in prison for rape and murder. Okay, those are the sinners. I am not a sinner. But God is saying everybody is a sinner. And I'm at a moment, I would call it a little bit of a crisis, because now I've got to figure out what definition of sin am I going to embrace? Well, I chose God's definition. And in that moment, I realized I'm not so golden. My destination has changed. I am not headed to heaven. Could you bring the next slide up? This is here. John 1, 4 through 5. In him was the life, and the life was the light of all mankind, the light that shines in darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. I've become an awakened soul, and the light of Christ is now shining in me. And if you can see that picture, that room is filthy. Filthy. Dust flying everywhere. And these slides look a lot bigger when I was doing them on my laptop. I'm sorry for that. So now I'm an awakened soul, and I realize that the things that I described to you that was sitting behind my image, that's what all this is. All of this is what's right there. And so I said, okay, God, here's the best I can do. My place is a mess, so why don't you give me an opportunity to clean up a few things, and then I feel like I'll be worthy enough to give my life to Jesus. I can make a commitment to him. So I choose three things. I choose the drunkenness and sex, and I was and cussing. I said, God, I'll take those off the board. So I'm 19, I'm 20 years old, I'm a male, I'm in college. No drinking, no sex. You can, well, for the males anyway, you can appreciate how miserable I might have been during that. And so I'm working my way through there, and 10 months, or it's about 8 months, and back then they had, churches would have what they call a revival. And it's 7 nights, and we're going every night. And the last night comes, and let's go to the next slide. There we go. Go to the, hit the note. So what I didn't realize, when it says, from the power of Satan to God, I'm under the power of Satan. I am bound up. I'm in chains by these things over here, and I don't even know. They've become so comfortable. I've become so used to them that I think it's normal. But now I've realized that I'm struggling. I've got a battle going on for my soul. And in Isaiah 61, the last two are the ones that probably meant the most to me, proclaim freedom for the captives and release from the darkness for the prisoners. That's where I was. I was captive to these things. I was a prisoner. And Jesus came to rescue me and free me from this. And so the last night, I'm sitting there, and that invitation comes. And I said, God, I said, it's time. I said, I don't really know what I'm doing other than I know I need you. I need a relationship with your son. I want to be forgiven for this stuff that I didn't even think was a big deal, but this stuff has separated me from you. For all these years, I've separated myself from you because of this. But you've taken care of this with your son. And so I walked down and said, I'm doing this. I go down, I meet with a man. And that night I prayed to receive Christ and enter into a relationship. That was July of 1980. Now there are, what I've come to realize as I was journeying towards Christ, there are hurdles that I had to overcome. And the first hurdle was I had to recognize that I was a sinner. Go from not a sinner to a sinner. That was the first hurdle. The next hurdle I had to get over was I had to sort out the definitions of sin and come to realize that again, I'm a sinful individual. The third hurdle was cleaning myself up, realizing that's an exercise in futility. But it was my process as I'm coming to a relationship with Jesus Christ. In Revelation 3:20, that says, Jesus says, behold, I stand and knock at the door. Whoever opens the door, I will come in, and I will dine with him, and he will dine with me. I had to be the one to open that door. I had to take a step of faith. It had to be my will that turned that doorknob and opened up. And then Jesus comes across the threshold and into my life. And back then, if you were dining with someone or having a meal, it was a very intimate time. And so what he's saying is, I want to come in and I want to have an intimate relationship with you. And so this relationship would start. And so, let's go to the next slide. Keep going. There we go. That's what I felt right there that night. I've never felt that before. Never. But that's what it felt like. To be forgiven, to be loved, accepted, joy, peace. Like the Lord Jesus stepping through that door and just taking me into his arms. To receive forgiveness is what I received and what I felt, grace and mercy. And then to know that I had an eternal inheritance, that Jesus Christ is offering me eternal life with him, but a life that would begin with him right here, a relationship that would begin with him. So, you know, I said I thought I was golden, right? Well, now I think I'm platinum because I've got Jesus in my life. My life is now ratcheted up. It's even better. And so in 9 months, I'm going to be getting married. And that's when I began to realize I'm not so platinum. Because this is where the hardships and the suffering begin. And it's not that I even had a difficult marriage, but you got two individuals that are trying to live with each other. And realizing you got differences. and things aren't going to be ordered like I thought they were going to be ordered, and there's not going to be all the peace that I thought I was going to have. And just as an outline, only because I'll be getting to these things later on, is married for 10 years, and it seemed like we had a pretty good relationship, but then the wheels start to come off a bit relationally. And the relationship just begins to die. I mean, it's not that we're even arguing and stuff, but for whatever reason, I did not figure out how to love this woman well enough to keep her. And so she eventually walks in one day and says, "I don't love you. I don't want to be married to you. And we're getting a divorce." She goes, "I don't want anything from you. I just don't want to be married to you anymore." And I knew that day might come, but the reality of it is a whole other thing to get hit in the face with that. So we've got that first hardship coming. While we're separated, I end up in an adulterous relationship. You know, the word "never" seems to be the kiss of death. If you say, "I will never, I would never do that." Well, never in a million years would I thought I would get involved with a married woman. But I sure did. I was very needy, and she just happened to show up at the right time, and I entered into that relationship with her. But I did get a taste of my depravity, because I didn't think I had any depravity. But I got a big dose of depravity in what I'm capable of. From the divorce, my daughter suffered emotional trauma. She had a very difficult first relationship with a boyfriend that was abusive. She had a very difficult relationship with her stepdad. So I've got that going on. Her brother's having to suffer through. And I can tell you guys that, divorce is one of the most, I think, selfish things that an individual can do. And I'm not condemning anybody here who has been through a divorce. If you have even been the one to divorce, please do not take that as condemnation. I am speaking out of my own personal experience, as my ex-wife chose to leave me and to see the scorched earth damage that it does to the children. It is, you can't describe it. But those of you who have been through it and lived through it, you know what I'm talking about, the damage it does to children. It is worth fighting for a family, regardless of how bad it is. Children rather have their parents yelling and screaming and fighting all the time and stay together, as opposed to break that family up. My daughter today suffers from fibromyalgia, which is a muscular disease that just causes the body to ache and gets inflamed. She suffers from cyclical vomiting. I'm not saying this is all because of that, but and then she struggles with anxiety. Two rebellious sons. With my ex-wife and I had a son that was rebellious, and then Terry and I got to enjoy a rebellious son. I was hoping I wouldn't have to repeat that, but it did. And it's very different having the rebellion not in your home and then having the rebellion in your home. Very, very different. Children that have struggled with drinking, with drugs, lying. This the hardship and the sufferings, you know, God just continues to bring. But at times though, it feels like, "I don't think I can take it anymore, God." It is just heart crushing. But He is so gracious. Not that He's taking it away, but He is so gracious in the moment to give us what we need, whether it's a word or encouragement or whatever. And in my experience, which I'll be sharing some with you, it is spot on. When the time comes, it's just perfect. All four kids have been married. Tyler's now divorced. Kind of eerie how his, almost a replica of his mother and I's divorce, where his wife comes through one day, says, "I don't love you. I don't want to be married to you anymore. And I'm divorcing." And so now we're living through that, and we're watching our two granddaughters have to suffer through what it is to live in a home where they don't have a home. Work. I've been fired twice. I've been laid off twice. And I got fired last summer. Absolute best day of my life. that was the absolute hardest job I've ever had, the most stressful job I've ever had, and I was about ready to just go ahead and resign anyway, and God beat me to it. And what a great day that was. It's kind of an odd thing, probably, to someone to say how great it was, but it was good. And so I retired in January, and so I'm trying to get used to that new life. It's been interesting because there are days I feel like I'm being domesticated, and I don't like the feeling of being domesticated. But God's helping me work through being domesticated, and that it's okay to be domesticated. I think you guys can relate to that, but that's a pride issue. That, you know, in the example of when Dave's, I'm making a bed. I don't normally make beds. Now I'm making beds. And fitted, sometimes fitted sheets just got to go on a certain way. And I put the fitted sheet and I'm going, well, Terry, this ain't going to roll, Terry. I know, because this thing's not fitting. So I pull it off and I put it back on. And finally I did it. And man, I'm just chirping in my mind. I'm not happy about this. I'm saying, God, this is terrible. And God says, he said, Gary, we have some good friends of ours we've met through pickleball. And the husband had what's called an ocular nerve stroke, where and typically it only happens in one eye. It happened in both eyes. So now he's got some blindness. He does not have 100% use. And he said, Gary, you think Greg would love to have his eyesight and be making this bet? I said, well, absolutely. He goes, well, what's your problem? You got great health. And he goes, on top of that, I don't care what I ask you to do. This is about attitude. Whatever I ask you to do, if it's making a bed, whatever it is, your significance is in me, and you need to focus on me because I'm the one you're doing this for. I said, all right, God, I get it. I have a great attitude about making the bed. But I will tell you, most of the stuff that I do, I'm thinking about Terry and whether or not this is going to please her as well, because she's come behind me a lot in life in helping me learn how things need to be done. And the very first thing I learned was how to fold a towel when we first got married. Because I folded that towel, she goes, that's not how we fold towels. So now, after 32 years, I know how to fold a towel. So I'm going to circle back to the sexual molesting story and Dad telling me that we don't need to tell each other we love each other. So sexually molested at 5, 25 years go by, 30 years. I hadn't even thought about this for whatever reason. And I can't even tell you what triggered the thought. But I start thinking about that and I start reliving what happened in that bathroom. And I was still married at the time, so I tell my wife, and also I tell my Paul about it. And I thought, well, I have some things that I need to talk to Dad about, work through a few things. And so we're talking, and I said, Dad, man, do you remember when I got sexually molested? And he said, no. I said, what? I said, you don't remember that? He said, you're in trouble. I don't know what you're talking about. So I said, wow. Okay. So, fast forward, say I'm 30. Fast forward 30 years. Okay. Every time that I would tell that story, and I never minded telling it, because I know that there are others, men and women, that have had to endure, whether it's one time or multiple times, sexual abuse, that I can connect to them. And so it's good that I went through that, but because it gives me a connection to people that have experienced the same thing, and I know what that feels like. So fast forward 30 years, I'm having lunch with a friend, and this topic comes up, and he said, you know, I experienced some sexual bad behavior from older boys when I was growing up. And he said, I told my dad about it. He didn't handle it very well, and it made me angry. And eventually I realized I needed to forgive my dad for that. And in that moment, it struck me that I need to forgive my dad. So I went home that day. Terry went home. I went for a walk, and I said, God, I want to ask you. I've been harboring all this anger towards my dad for all these years, and the tears were hurt. It was the hurt. And a lot of times when you have those tears, there's healing that God is doing in us. Well, 30 years is a long time for healing, you know. But it's okay. It's relative to God. And I said, I just ask you to forgive me that I've harbored this anger towards my dad. And then I said, God, I'd like to talk to my dad. Because he's already died. He's passed away. And so I'm walking along. I said, Dad, I just want you to know that I forgive you for not remembering that I was sexually molested. But I want to ask you to forgive me for harboring anger towards you. And gosh, it was fabulous. The peace that came from that conversation. And to, I think I'm pretty much over the tears. Obviously, I got a little struggle going on, but it's not like it used to be. But mainly, it's really, I think, tears of joy. Because God just, you know, at times, he just overwhelms me with his goodness. And that's what this is, more than the tears of the hurt and the pain that I went through. And so it was amazing to have that moment and to be able to experience God in that way, to be able to forgive my dad who wasn't even there anymore. But it was a very real moment to be able to forgive him. So, who is God? Who are they? Well, you're a God of grace. He was very gracious to me over those years. He's a God of mercy. He's a God of forgiveness. He's a God of honor. It was a way, I think, for me to honor my dad, mm-hmm. to walk through that with him. So obviously, what do you want me to do, God? Well, I want you to forgive your father. And so I was able to do that. And then, with the Gary, we don't need to tell each other that we love each other anymore. So I come to Christ in 1980. My dad comes to Christ in 1981. And I probably, as an adult, I probably started thinking again, it would be really nice one day if dad would give me a hug. And the dad would tell me that he loved me. And I understand why dad couldn't do that, because he never got an ounce of attention from his dad. And so dad was doing the best he could. And physical touch and hugging and verbally expressing love, he just didn't have any. And I'm okay with that, because I understood what he grew up with. So I finally could embrace that. It didn't mean I didn't want it, because I sure desired it. I had a yearning for it, but he just couldn't give it to me. And so after he comes to Christ, a little bit after that, I walk in the house one day. Walks up to me. Gives me a hug. Tells me he loves me. So who are you, Lord? Man, a God of compassion. A God of a tender-hearted God. Loving kindness. And I was just, it just took my dad and I's relationship to another place, you know, to be able to share that with dad. I mean, there were times he didn't give me a kiss on the cheek. You know, so it's a little bonus right there. But that's who God is. You know? And it's learning who he is as he takes us, as he brings restoration. He takes through difficult times and is hanging in there with him, experiencing his grace and mercy as he takes us through the hardships. So, all the sufferings that I've been through, whether it's being an only child and the loneliness of that, or dealing with the pride and image, or, the sexual molesting, or a parent not being able to express their love to you, going through a divorce and dealing with children, going through an adultery relationship, dealing with rebellious kids, and all the stuff that has come with that. The beauty in all of that is that it gives me touch points, meaning I can touch other people because I can minister to other people and I can relate to them and all the sufferings that God has given. And how good is that? What do you want me to do? And Gary, I want you to share your life with people, with your sufferings in life. I want you to give that away because it will help other people. It will connect you to people in the midst of your sufferings. And he said, it is a good thing. It is from ashes to beauty. He does it over and over. When it looks like ashes, just beauty rises up out of the ashes. In his timing and out of his grace and love and mercy. So I'm going to stop right there. It's the end of today for me. And I'd be happy if anybody has any observations or a thought or a comment or a question. I'm happy to take that, or we can call it. So I'll just take a moment if anybody's got anything they have to say or ask. Man, they're not quite as smooth as they used to be. Some of that's left me, but my mind remembers what it could do. But my body's just not quite following them these days. But I do enjoy. I love Nancy. Have you not been to some of the talent shows where my family and I did the? The white mask and the white gloves, dressed in all black. It's called the Jabberwockies. So yes, we've done that.
You still look good in the leotard.
Thank you, bro. Yes.
Have you talked to your children about some of your past when you were talking?
I've talked to all of them about all four of them. They know about the sexual molesting. They know about the adultery. So I'm trying to be as transparent as I can with them. When I felt that it was, they were at an appropriate age and able to have that kind of conversation. I don't really want any of my life to be hidden from them. And so that's a really good question. I appreciate you asking that. And my daughter suffered some of the same thing on the sexual side, and so it was something I could certainly relate to her and feel that pain. She felt so. I encourage you guys to just be willing to open your life with your children when you think it's appropriate, to share that with them, because we're kind of messed up people. We're pretty flawed, and it's okay to share the flawedness with our children.
Did your mom tell you that she loved you?
Oh, mom, all the time, man. She's all about love and touch and hugs and kisses, all the time. So that's kind of met that need for me. And my dad's mom was like that as well. And so the need was getting met. I just needed it from dad. And he just couldn't give it, But it's all right. I think, as you have time to, you think about your parents and how they handled you, you got to look back another generation. You got to look and see what they grew up with. And understand that, because they're going to give you probably the best they can give you. And sometimes it's going to look really bad, but they're just doing the best they can. And sometimes alcohol or drugs or something get a hold of them, and that just makes things worse. But just have some, if you can, a little compassion to understand where they came from and what that looked like. Well, guys, thank you so much. I appreciate your time and your attention. Thank you.